Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini. Welcome back to the podcast. Come, little film fans. We'll take you away to a world filled with magic, wonder, whimsy, and the music from John Debney. Composer extraordinaire, 40 years in the business. It's touched everything you've probably listened to, heard, but we are thrilled to be speaking to our good friend from the L and the A. Let's put our hands together and clap for John Debney. How are you, John? How's things in your life?
Thanks, Mark. Well, that's awfully sweet of you. What an introduction. No, I think you're right, actually, 40. That stopped me right in my tracks. You know, I guess it's been 40 years. It doesn't feel that way. But anyway, it's great to be with you today.
Excellent, excellent. Glad to have you back on the podcast. Last time we spoke was probably one of the best interviews I've had in a long, 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 long time.
Wow.
I say this as a film fan because I put music on a higher regard than the narrative. But then again, you can't do the magic you do without the narrative. So it's such a wonderfully cohesive and it's a mix that makes the best of both worlds. So I loved Come Away, I loved Jingle Jangle, and now we are with a doubleheader of Luck and Hocus Pocus 2. So how are you dealing with a year that's filled with so many musical riches?
Boy, what a great question. You know, I've been so blessed to, weirdly, Mark, to have worked all the way through COVID, thankfully working all the way through COVID, because you can imagine composers are pretty solitary. And you know, I would just sort of come into my room and in our building and work away with nobody around. So it actually kind of worked through COVID. And I was lucky enough to, during COVID, to do a couple of projects, one being Come Away, as you said, another being Jingle Jangle. I think Jingle Jangle sort of was at the beginning of COVID. Come Away was in the middle somewhere. And then Luck started kind of as we're coming out. And so it was an interesting time because for all of us, but creatively for me, it was very interesting to try to deal with everything we've all been dealing with COVID related things and sickness and death and just, you know, all that dark stuff that we all have to deal with as human beings. But then to somehow channel that into music, and that, I guess, was my safety net, you know, that I would put it that way, sort of my own way to therapeutically, I guess, deal with all this stuff. So in hindsight, you know, as you're going through it, you don't know, but I guess in hindsight, that was what I was going through. And then lo and behold, you know, Luck started. We ended up recording in London a couple times. We recorded in London one period of time. I think that was around last year, November, maybe. And then fade out, fade in. We actually went to London for the second half. And that was lovely and fun. But everybody had to be tested. And everybody was in, all the players were in masks. And which was fine. You know, that's, we've all gotten used to that. So it's been a wonderful, rich kind of journey that I'm very, very fortunate to be able to say I did. Then, as you said, we ended up kind of the end of this year, or not the end of this year, the beginning of this year, middle of this year, and then with Hocus Pocus 2, which has been an amazing ride for me. You know, it was sort of bookending Hocus Pocus 1 and now Hocus Pocus 2. And the lovely director, Anne Fletcher, and I just really, really, really clicked. And we had a lot of fun. And I love her vision. And there you go. We finished Hocus Pocus 2, did a lot of recording, still in masks, but just to be safe. And here we are. Now I'm here with you. So it's been a great busy time, which I'm so thankful for.
Well, you know, you bring up Ann Fletcher, and one of the things is really kind of cute and fun about being a fan of something is you just never know how the zeitgeist of the public conscious is going to work. What's going to be, you know, something that maybe yesterday's news will be picked up by an audience and be the next It's a Wonderful Life. It's a Christmas Story. And I find it so funny but charming how Hocus Pocus has just taken hold. I mean, you go to Home Depot, you see the Sanderson sisters blow up dolls, things like that. So it's kind of like, you know, that expression, don't burn any bridges. Do composers have something like, don't throw anything away? Because you never know, 28 years from late now, someone's going to want to know what other magic we'll have in a drawer somewhere. So how did you dig back in that with Anne?
Great question. First of all, I've rarely been given that opportunity to revisit something that I've done so, you know, long ago. So what Anne and I talked about initially was she really wanted to pay the homage to the original film and score. And to her credit, she used a lot of a third of the movie is musically derived from Hocus Pocus 1. So I got to sort of pull out the scores and revisit those themes, but then reorchestrate them, rearrange them for this new film. And then the rest of the score was brand new. So there were new themes. You know, I had to come up with sort of a theme for the sisters themselves that wasn't the main theme. So I came up with a couple of sub-themes. Winnie has her own theme, and Sarah, because I think Sarah has a bigger role in this movie, in the number two, I sort of did a little waltz for Sarah, and Anne quite liked it, and we had a lot of fun with that. So it was wonderful. It was a little bit daunting, you know, because I looked at that original score that I did so long ago as a young man. I was probably in my middle 30s, you know, 36, 7 in there. And I had no time to do that score. James Horner was going to do that score, and then he had to, at the last minute, bail off that score. And lo and behold, for a number of reasons, and lo and behold, James recommended me to do that score, which I'm forever grateful, because that really started my career. But anyway, I had 2 weeks to write that first score, and, you know, no sleep, lots of coffee, you know. We even had to record at night, which is an interesting thing. We recorded about 6 or 7 nights in a row because I had to write during the day. You can imagine. So I'd write, you know, all the way up to when I would have to go to the studio, and then we'd go record, and then I'd come back in the morning, early morning. And it was like that. So the daunting part of that was that score to me stands out as sort of my own benchmark for being the score that where I was let out of my cage. I don't know if that makes sense, where sort of the floodgates opened and, you know, the universe said, here it is. And I just had to go, and it came out, and I'm proud of that score. So in revisiting it, you know, initially before I'd written the new score, I was struck by, you know, I had all kinds of self-doubt. Like, can I write something this good again? Or, you know, all those things you sort of go through, that we all go through. So I just started to work, and slowly but surely came up with these other themes. And they're kind of all fun themes, and they kind of all work together now. And what was really cool is we recorded Hocus Pocus 1 material for this new movie, and we recorded the new material, and it's all kind of from the same family. So that's sort of the way it all ended up. And even the end of Hocus Pocus 2, there's a little tag teaser for the fans to kind of hint at, you know, who knows, maybe there'll be another one someday. So even that little teaser contains a bit of the new themes.
Oh, very cool.
And, you know, there could be a hint. I don't know if they decide to do another one, you know. So that was sort of the way I approached it all with trepidation initially. And then excitement and joy, and we just sort of were off to the races.
Yeah. Well, you just gave me a whole wealth of things that I could tee up for my next question. I think one of the best ones I could do is speaking to the credits. One of the things that was most impacting to me is there's a point in the credits, I'd say with about 2 minutes left before the little, we'll just call it the Disney touch at the end. It's like they always want to continue the story. But there's this tinge of sadness that you feel like we were so lucky and what a treat to get to witness another adventure with these characters again. And there's this music that just feels like we may never see them again. And it's so heartbreaking. And so I'm sorry I can't, you know, dissect which one that is, but that just goes to your talents, the way how dynamic you are.
Mark, that's very kind of you. I think you're referring to, I believe, and it is touches us all. It touched me terribly. Where, if I'm thinking of the right area, where Winnie has to say good. Well, I don't want spoilers, but Winnie has to. Something happens, and Winnie is heartbroken. And there's that moment of the great Bette Midler. Gosh, I mean, where she just breaks everybody's hearts on screen. And we worked. That's an interesting piece of music because I had initially written it. And then Anne and I talked about it more, and we both felt, actually Anne said, you know, I think we can go sadder. I think we can be more heartbreaking with it. And I said, wow, really? And she said, yeah, what do you? So we came up with the idea of this sort of recurring little number of chords with the solo voice in it, which is sort of representative of Winnie's character and her longing for her sisters, without spoiling it. And a lot of people have said the same thing you did, where they reference the fact that it really is heartbreaking at the end. And I love it because I think Anne, if she were on with us, she would tell you that they reshot that ending. To make it more heartbreaking, to make it more magical, but heartbreaking and ultimately uplifting. Yeah. So if that's the spot you're talking about, I agree with you. It was really sort of, wow, it sort of hit everyone. And all of us, when we were recording, we all felt it too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just shows you the impact that the music has. And, you know, the one thing I've been most curious about is, in your mind, in your experience, is it more important to hit the right timing, hit the right notes, or is it more important to have just this amazingly flourish filled theme that just kind of covers everything?
Wow. Well, that's a great question too. It depends. It's sometimes both, and it's sometimes one or the other, but in this case, it was sort of crucial, I think, for me to find, and Anne helped me all along the way. She's such a great storyteller. She helped me know where the moment was where we really need to start to pull on the heartstrings. And all great directors do that. They'll say, you know, I think you could go farther here or do this. And at that point in this movie, it was all about the tone, and it was all about the feel. The rest of the movie is so intricate, and the timings are crucial. I mean, down to the frame, from when things hit, because, you know, it is, most of the movie is such a romp. It's sort of, in my mind, and I hope the ladies don't mind this if they hear it, in my mind, these, you know, incredible actresses are sort of doing a little bit of a Three Stooges, but much more sophisticated version. And they do it so well and with such aplomb and, you know, verve that that's the way I looked at it. And I think that's the way Anne looked at it. So the timings were extremely important, and a little accents. And many times we would add accents for, you know, bits of things that we see on the screen. So anyway, it's a little bit of both at all times, but I think in that one scene you're referencing, that was all meant to just be, you know, tone and heart all the way to the end of that scene. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to say that two of the standout scenes are the part in Walgreens where they're trying to, they're being duped into thinking the lotions contain, well, I'll let people see that. But the other one was, the other one too, was when there's a pacing thing. And it's a lot like you said, where Sarah and Bette are coming for screen, yeah, and Kathy's kind of going one way and then they turn and do an about face. So it is, you're right, there is so much physical comedy to this that you almost have to watch the movie three times just to focus on Kathy for one period, and then Sarah, and then Bette. So I guess, you have to maybe, I mean, clearly you watch this more than once, but what you tend to gravitate towards? And is it things on scene, or is it more things that you'd have talks with Anne about?
Well, good one. That scene in particular, I'll just stay with your example. That scene I also redid because Anne thought those turns could be a little bit, could be choreographed a little differently in the music. And she was right. And so we redid that. I just, you know, because I'm familiar with the characters in the case of this movie, it was just a joy, like a joyful rediscovering of our characters. And I must say, the wonderful actress from who plays she's a very beautiful witch in the beginning, who makes an appearance, from Ted Lasso, I forget her name. But anyway, she is so magnificent, and she makes an appearance. I always hoped that she would come back, but I think she comes back in a different way without spoiling it.
Yeah,
I get what you mean. So I think I always look at the whole thing. Honestly, Mark, I view the film a few times. I then sort of discover in my mind, and I make notes of sort of where we're going, what I have to do. The beginning of this movie takes place way back in the 1600s. So I had to kind of work with that. And that in the main is a lot of Hocus Pocus One, because which Anne tempted it that way. And I thought it was really great, because immediately, hopefully the audience can sort of hear those themes and go, oh yeah, God, we're back. It's Hocus Pocus. So for me, when I first saw it, it was all that. It was sort of, oh, they're a little bit different here. I need to write a theme for this. I need to do something here. And then honestly, Mark, it's just nuts and bolts of getting under the hood and starting to write and just see what comes out. And in this case, the initial Winnie theme that I came up with is a kind of a lyrical bouncy thing. And I don't know why it was like that, but Anne liked it. And then later in the movie, it becomes very dark. And and dark and dire. So sometimes, honestly, you know, I don't plan a lot of it. I just sort of believe and go with that. And then what comes out. And then it's all about honing it and making it fit and working with a great director like Anne. That's okay. Really how it happens.
Well, actually, there's one more thing. You know, the fact that this movie is almost, especially when you said using so much of the previous score, it's like a time capsule, because yeah, it's a continuation of the story, but it's built on something a lot like earlier chapters in any franchise. But right, here we are 30 plus years removed. You know, I look back at myself and say, you know, in architecture and constructions, we did things differently. You know, you don't put carpet in bathrooms anymore. You don't use asbestos. You don't use certain things that were common. So are there things that, looking back, you go, God, we don't do that anymore, or time signatures have changed, or can you just lean on the time capsule and let it be that?
Well, that's a great question. You know, initially going into this, I thought maybe we create a little more contemporary sound. But honestly, Anne led me the other direction. And what I mean is, the way Anne and her editor and great music editor also tempt this movie, in some of the key fun moments and some of the bigger moments, they reference the first score. So for me, it was really interesting, because where I initially thought, you know, I might get a little more contemporary. I might make things, well, one thing's for sure, I wanted to make it scarier. And that was one of the things that Anne and I spoke about. So this Hocus Pocus 2 score is much scarier, I think. And to address your question, the first Hocus Pocus score was much more whimsical. And yet there were darkness in places. But to me, this second film, in a good way, gets darker because you have these contemporary young ladies who are, again, without doing a big spoiler, who, you know, get into magic and witchcraft and in a good way. And then they, you know, in their own way, one of them is, we find out something very super secret about her, and maybe she has powers. So a lot of what I did was, if it weren't in the Hocus Pocus 1 realm, was Hocus Pocus 2 realm is darker. And so I used a lot more darker colors and synthetic textures and kind of aggressive orchestral things. But in the main, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a reinvention of the wheel, to put it that way, Mark. And that was from Anne. It's like, If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I think she was absolutely spot on. And so, you know, the stuff that we retained, I think, is nostalgic and it's wonderful. And it brings back those themes that we all, thankfully, that people love. And then, you know, this new one is darker. So I think when you listen to the score on its own, love your opinion too. I think that people might find more areas of darkness. And I think that's why I love the film so much. I love number two because it, you know, it hints at a lot of issues that are contemporary and that are different from Hocus Pocus 1. Hocus Pocus 1, you're right, was a much different era. It was in the 90s, you know, way back when. It was so much simpler then, you know, in a lot of ways. And so Hocus 1 was sort of imbued with all the lightness and whimsy that of the time. And the great Kenny Ortega, our director, directed that in a beautiful way. So the filmmaking technique is a little different, I think, between 1 and 2. I think what Anne did was a much more contemporary version of it. And yet it still pay the homage that I think you would need. So yeah, they're different films. I just saw a good bit of Focus One the other day because I was at a screening at the El Capitan here in Hollywood. And I must say, looking at the first 20, 30 minutes, it certainly holds up. And it holds up in a really like nostalgic way. And for me, number two, it sort of is very contemporary and it holds up in that regard. I think, you know, you learn about these young girls and you see our great characters as young girls now, without hopefully spoiling the whole thing. And then we come to present day. So I think you're right. And you started out the whole discussion with the zeitgeist of it all. I think some people may not care for Hocus Pocus 2 as much as they like the first one. But I would remind people, most of the things I've heard have been really positive about 2. And I think 2, just like 1, my guess is that it's going to grow on people. And then, let's say in a few years, 2 might be the one that people remember most. Because it was like, oh, you know, back in 2022, I watched number 2. And that was when I was a younger kid. And you know what I mean? So that's how it goes. And I think, you know, I would say, gosh, if we're lucky enough to do a number 3, how fun would that be? And what would that be? I have no idea. But anyway, it is just, as you mentioned, it's so gratifying that the fans, and I said this the other night, and I'm sorry to go on so much, but the fans really made this new one happen. It was the fans' love of the first one and such fan support and rabid exciting, you know, excitement with fans, and that's why this one happened. So There's a big fan base out there, as you mentioned. So who knows? Hopefully we'll do another one day.
Or a TV series or animated series or something.
TV series would be cool. You know what else would be cool? Would be a musical.
Yeah.
They've been hinting at this for years. And it's always a hint. So I don't know what's going on. And hopefully one's going to happen. And I don't know. I'm free if they need me.
Well, they have your number. Clearly, they know where you live. But you know what's kind of cute, though? It's, you know, there's almost like a Jingle Jangle connection, you know, the part where Forrest Whitaker looks at the three guys and goes, background dancers? And the fact that in Hocus Pocus 2, there's that sort of fourth wall breaking, like, are they singing to us? Like, is this?
You're absolutely right. There is that. It's so interesting that you bring. Yeah. One other person mentioned that to me, and, you know, over the last few months, and like, oh, and they're right. You are right.
But that's the fun that, you know, a movie like this and a series gets to have. And even so much, you know, the young actress who plays the young Bette Midler, I don't think that anybody could have gotten those mannerisms down so well if they weren't a fan of the movie. You know, it just goes to show the gravity. True. So
isn't she wonderful? Everybody remarks how she just nails it. I mean, it's just perfect. And I look forward to seeing her do more things because, boy, is she great. What would that be like? You know, a TV show could be, you can have a lot of fun. You could be in the 1600s sometimes, and you could be in the contemporary times. There's all kinds of things you could do. And the neat thing is now that we have all those streaming services, thank you, Disney Plus, why not? Why not do something fun like that? It might be really cool.
Well, with any luck, we'll see it. But now, before our time is up, let's just jump into luck. Can you give me three words that maybe describe your sort of template, your path forward, your mindset? I want to see if they're the same three things that I could think of. But let's go. Go, John. Go.
It's really cool of you. I'll tell you, first and foremost, the thing that spoke to me and really spoke to my heart was the storyline of luck. The little girl in luck, not Samantha, who's our main character, but she has a little friend who's with her at the orphanage, looks exactly like my granddaughter.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes you struggle with themes. You really do as a composer. Sometimes they come to you in the middle of the night and but this one wasn't much of a struggle because I just wrote this theme for my granddaughter who, you know, looks just like the character in Luck. So that was the first thing. And when I did that and played that for John Lasseter and our director, Peggy Holmes, they just fell in love with it. I mean, everybody fell in love with this main theme. So then I was off to the races. Then it became writing the Land of Luck theme was next on my plate. That was a hard one because I wrote, you know, I wanted to pay my love and homage to the Sherman brothers. And so I'm admitting a little something. And I've known Dick Sherman for most of my life. And I wanted to write something for the Land of Luck that rightly or wrongly, people might someday go, oh, that sounds like we're at Disneyland or, you know, we're on a ride. And that was the way John Lasseter described it. He goes, it's something that, you know, people want to go to this land. Like he goes, like at Disneyland, they want to go to this and live in this world. And that was the directive for the Land of Luck. So I had to find that theme. And that took a while because I got very manic about it. I kept writing themes after themes. And the greatest thing was, because I'm with John Lasseter, who's one of the most brilliant genius filmmakers of the 20th century, as we know, he liked one of them in their number 12 or something like that. And that literally became the Land of Luck theme. And he was right. It's just one of those themes that you hear it and it makes you happy. And then later in the movie, I get to really bring it out, make it beautiful, make it big and soar. So it was the first theme was, I call it Sam's theme, I called it Sam's theme, but it was really for my granddaughter, but Sam's theme. And then the next one was the Land of Luck theme. And then past that, there were little ancillary themes for the dragon. And that's about all I can tell you. What were your three takeaways? What did you feel?
Well, without sounding like, I really hate comparing one artist to another, but it felt like I was watching a Miyazaki film. I felt like you shared that sort of mysticism that Joe Hisaishi does with his.
Yeah, I love him. I love Joe.
And I just think that you have such a way of creating, like you used nostalgia earlier. I don't think you're human. I think you're this perpetual machine that just spits out, you know, golden era of Hollywood sounds, and just you're able to just make like bring people through the screen. I think that's what I love most about talking to you and your music.
How sweet of you to say that. You know, if that's true, and that's a very sweet thing to say, I always, you know, I'm telling you, Mark, I hearken back to my parents, my upbringing. And you know this, but I'll just very quickly, I grew up in the Disney family, meaning my father worked at Walt Disney Studios for 40 years, over 40 years. He knew Walt personally. I met Walt personally a number of times. And long story short, I grew up with that zeitgeist, that Disney thing. And whatever that Disney thing is, it is certainly in my DNA. I know that to be a fact. And so much that sometimes when I'm meeting with a filmmaker maybe that I haven't worked with, they'll know my history and they'll go, well, we really don't want it Disney sounding, you know? But I always take it as a compliment, because that whatever that is, it's just in me and I can pull it out at times, and or it just comes out. And I just always say that it's the love that I got, that I received as a child from my parents and their support, and growing up in that Disney family, that I guess made me the kind of person I am and kind of composer I am, that that I do love going into that kind of magical fantasy world. And that's why I think why Come Away was so special for me, because Come Away is the story of Peter and Wendy, and that's Disney, really.
Yeah,
even though Disney didn't do the movie, but I loved the movie, and that was a way for me to explore the childhood, you know, fantasy or mystical fantasy of what you just said. And I guess that's, you know, why I feel still like a child in many ways, even though I'm a much older man now. But thank you for that. I love tapping into it, whatever that is.
Yeah. Well, it's whimsical without being too heavy-handed. It's, you know, you always have heart in the score. So there's whimsy, there's heart, and there's just fun. I think that's what's so fun about it, what's so great about these scores. And I think the Land of Luck theme and you getting tapped for this was just, let's just call it kismet. I think this was, you were the right man for the job. So John, as always, an absolute pleasure to be speaking to you. I do not want to keep you from anything. Sorrow is such sweet parting. And
yes. It is.
So just real quickly, what else do you have going on and when can we do this again?
We can do it anytime you'd like. I'm working on a wonderful new movie called 80 for Brady, which is a really fun movie, which I can't spoil. Has something to do with Tom Brady. That's all it is.
Okay.
But anyway, and a lot of things, number of things for next year. And I'm going to be concertizing through the holidays, which is going to be kind of fun. I'm going to be doing Elf Live, which will be fun.
Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah. And coming to a city near you, I hope. And so all kinds of stuff. I'm just, you know, the most blessed human being you've ever met. But it's always great talking to you, and we can do it anytime you want. Just call me and we'll set time aside and do it.
Excellent. Well, everyone, check out Hocus Pocus 2, Luck. It'll take you weeks to get through John's back catalog, but there's something for everybody in that list. So thank you, everyone, for your time, and we will catch you next time.